امبارح شربوني دواء وكنت بسعر بالليل.
Every day, 9-year-old Mohammed Atala fills up big plastic tanks with water. He then loads these tanks onto a wheelchair and pushes it a mile back home. Mohammed makes this trip every single day. He says he's in pain from all the pushing. This is just a small window into what the humanitarian aid crisis in Gaza looks like. Children are dying of thirst and starvation. We know that Israel is throttling most deliveries into Gaza, and the trucks that do make it in are at risk of being mobbed or even shot at by Israel as it fights Hamas. So some Middle Eastern countries have taken to dropping pallets of supplies from the air. But over the last few days, U.S. planes have also been seen streaking over the skies above Gaza, dropping parachutes carrying military ready-to-eat meals onto the beaches and streets below. So why did Israel's biggest ally feel the need to take matters into their own hands like this?
It is just remarkable to see Netanyahu essentially thumb his nose at the U.S. So the U.S. continues to send weapons, but it cannot get Israel to just open up aid crossings.
Today, why pushback from the Biden administration is louder than ever as a member of Israel's war cabinet pays them a visit. From CNN, this is Tug of War. I'm David Rein. Alex Marquardt is here. He is CNN's chief national security correspondent. Alex, my first question is, why was a member of the Israeli war cabinet in Washington, D.C. this week?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. And what you'll hear from the Biden administration is that this is such a critical moment, really, on two fronts. One, to get the ceasefire deal across the finish line, which they say the Israelis have essentially agreed to, but also to get more aid into Gaza. And we saw that horrific situation last week in northern Gaza, just outside Gaza City, where hundreds of Palestinians were killed as they rushed that aid convoy. And that just really highlighted the fact that there not only isn't enough aid in Gaza, but it's just not getting to the right place. And so I think they see Benny Gantz as someone who they can work with probably a little bit better than Benjamin Netanyahu. This has created quite the firestorm back in Israel, which has been rather interesting to watch. And the Biden administration has really rolled out the red carpet for Gantz in that they gave him meetings with everybody at the senior levels of the administration, except for the president himself. And so, the administration is defending themselves, saying this guy is a member of the war cabinet. You know, there are three main members of the war cabinet, and there's a war going on. So they need to engage with him. And certainly they know, the administration, that Gantz is a prospective prime minister should Netanyahu's government fall apart.
So he's like a big rival of Netanyahu's, but they're all in the war cabinet together working on this. So how should we look at those optics then? Because in normal times, I can't imagine high-ranking U.S. officials taking meetings with someone that Netanyahu's like, hey, he doesn't represent Israel here.
Well, from Israel's perspective, Gantz is in the war cabinet because he's the head of a major party. The other main member of the war cabinet is Yoav Gallant, the defense minister. And both of those men are rivals to Netanyahu. And to show you how irritated Netanyahu is by this, I spoke with someone who was familiar with all these meetings, who said that Netanyahu barred the Israeli embassy here in Washington from helping out with those meetings. Normally, if there were a major figure from a foreign government visiting, you would see the ambassador going to those meetings. And that didn't happen. The embassy was blocked from doing that. And essentially, Netanyahu's office has said that Gantz is here not representing the state of Israel.
Wow.
He's a member of the war cabinet, but he's a major player. And, you know, if the Netanyahu coalition were to fall apart, then Gantz would certainly have a very good chance of being the next prime minister.
So I guess I'm wondering how the administration then feels about Netanyahu and his and kind of the hard line that he has kind of spearheaded in this operation in Gaza. As I think about these airdrops that the U.S. has been doing in recent days, like, we know that the U.S. is the loudest and most important voice in Israel's ear. So couldn't they just say to Israel, hey, open the gates, let more aid in, and make sure it gets there safely instead of this really inefficient way of airdropping from the sky onto the beach? Like, why go through all this trouble for what is just a drop in the bucket anyway?
Yeah, you would think that, right? I mean, the U.S. has a huge amount of leverage over Israel, billions of dollars of military aid every year, that aid continuing even as global criticism mounts. And yet that leverage has not proven effective in essentially getting Israel to do what the U.S. wants it to do. Putting aside a ceasefire for right now, what is clear is that more aid is needed in Gaza. And right now it's only going in to the southern part of the Gaza Strip. And the U.S. has been pleading, pressuring, all but demanding that Israel open up northern border crossings. And there are several to choose from. Israel has resisted that for a variety of reasons. And so what has happened is these airdrops, which, as you say, are hugely inefficient, they're extremely expensive, and they don't have much of an impact. Even if you get tens of thousands of meals into Gaza in an airdrop, that's just a drop in the bucket for the more than 2 million people who are on the brink of starvation. And it is just remarkable to see Netanyahu essentially thumb his nose at the U.S. So the U.S. continues to send weapons, but it cannot get Israel to just open up aid crossings.
We're trying to work out a deal between Israel and Hamas on the hostages being returned and immediate ceasefire in Gaza for at least the next 6 weeks, and to allow the surge of aid to the entire Gaza Strip, not just the south, but the entire Gaza Strip.
You're hearing the frustration from the Biden administration really ramp up. A couple days ago, we heard President Biden talking about the need for an immediate ceasefire for at least 6 weeks. That was the first time that we heard the words immediate ceasefire come out of the president's mouth, quickly followed by Vice President Harris.
And the Israeli government must do more to significantly increase the flow of aid.
Who coupled that with
no excuses. They must open new border crossings. They must not impose any unnecessary restrictions on the delivery of aid. They must ensure humanitarian personnel, sites, and convoys are not targeted.
And you can be sure that that is what Benny Gantz has been hearing from administration officials over the course of the past few days. So the pressure really is building. We have not yet seen the administration threatened to condition aid. They still say that aid is going to Israel in order to defend themselves. But that irritation is clearly growing.
I'll have more with Alex in just a bit. Welcome back to Tug of War. I'm speaking with CNN's Alex Marquardt.
So on these talks, then, about a ceasefire and a hostage release, we're quickly approaching the start of Ramadan, which is kind of when Prime Minister Netanyahu said they would move into Rafah if there's not a deal in place by then. So what is the latest on those talks?
And that prospect is really what scares everybody. Ramadan, obviously, in a hugely important month in the Arab and Muslim world, and if Israel were to ratchet up its military operations at the start of Ramadan, that would really inflame things, not just among Palestinians, but all across the Arab and Muslim worlds. It does appear that things are progressing on the ceasefire front. And I call it the ceasefire deal because there's so many different parts of it. You have the hostage release, of course. Also, you know, Gazans are desperate for a break in the fighting, and that this would be at least 6 weeks. And then you need that aid to go into Gaza. So we've had talks in Paris and in Qatar and in the last few days in Cairo, and they appear to be moving incrementally, but it's clear that they have not crossed the finish line. And Israel, for its part, according to the U.S., has agreed to the framework, but is also demanding a list of the hostages who are still being held by Hamas, who is dead, who is alive, so that they can know who to expect. Because this is not just about releasing hostages, it's also about a trade in that Hamas is demanding potentially hundreds of Palestinian prisoners being held in Israeli prisons. Hamas is saying, we can't give you that list until the ceasefire starts. Oh. And that's essentially a reference to the fact that they're being held all over Gaza by all these different groups. And they don't have, they say, this list.
They're saying it's just too chaotic and everybody's so spread out, so we literally need the guns to go silent before we can actually see who is available to return.
And that's the argument that Hamas made last time. Remember at the end of November when we had that 7-day pause, every day Hamas came up with a new list, and they essentially used that break in the fighting to go around and figure out where people were, who was alive, and who they could trade the next day.
Let me ask you this, though, Alex. When we think about Hamas and kind of their demands here, is there a world where the longer this drags on and the more they keep putting up these demands they know well Israel will not be ready to jump at, that this kind of works out for them and tensions just kind of get inflamed all across the region because Hamas can say, hey, Israel is still just bombing us to smithereens and causing all this chaos and starving our people in Gaza? Like, how cynical do they kind of operate here in these talks?
Yeah, certainly there is reason to believe that they are looking at this cynically and that the desperation of the Palestinian people in Gaza works in their favor because it turns, you know, global sentiment against Israel. At the same time, they know what leverage they have. They know the immense pressure that Netanyahu is facing because the hostages who are still being held. There's no doubt that Hamas would love a break in the fighting. It would give them an opportunity to essentially to regroup, rearm. And they know that with these hostages who they hold, they can get some very significant prisoners out of Israeli prisons. We're not just talking about the women and children we saw released last time. We're talking about people who, as Israel says, have blood on their hands. They have life sentences. And so when Hamas offers or has these Israeli soldiers, they're certainly going to be demanding a very high price.
And of course, in the middle of all this, innocent Palestinian women and children just trying to survive. Alex, thank you.
Thank you.
Tug of War is a production of CNN Audio. This episode was produced by Paolo Ortiz and me, David Rind. Our senior producer is Haley Thomas. Dan DeZula is our technical director, and Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of CNN Audio. We get support from Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dionora, Lenny Steinhardt, James Andres, Nicole Pesaru, and Lisa Namorow. Special thanks to Caroline Patterson, Rebecca Metzler, Diane Ruggiero, and Katie Hinman. We will be back on Friday. In the meantime, CNN.com or the CNN 5 Things podcast for the very latest. Talk to you next time.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.